about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Mays, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Rick Kustich, and he'll be answering your most important questions on hunting muskie with a fly. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. And the recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Rick Kustich about hunting muskie with a fly. When you stay at Tarpon Key Lodge in Belize, you are only a step away from fly fishing for tarpon, permit, and bonefish. In fact, you may see permit tailing right off the deck of your cabana. At Tarpon Key Lodge, you fish the tides and not the clock, and that makes all the difference in the world. You can fish the lagoon for tarpon or the flats for permit and bonefish. It's your choice. Tarpon Key Lodge is located on a private island just 30 minutes from Placentia. You can fish with world-class guides like Charles Leslie Sr. or make it a do-it-yourself trip and take one of the kayaks out and spend the day alone. If you're looking for that grand slam, Tarpon Key Lodge in Belize is the place to go. Book your next adventure now. Visit www.tarponkey.com. That's TARPONCAYE.com. Before we introduce Rick, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Rick's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Rick's latest book, Hunting Muskie with a Fly. This is provided to us courtesy of Stackpole Books, the publisher. And if you'd like to find out more about the books that Stackpole publishes, go to stackpolebooks.com, stackpolebooks.com. So here's how you can win Rick's book, Hunting Muskie with a Fly. You have to answer the question that I ask at the end of the show. It might be two questions, so be prepared. The questions will be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in that text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win Rick's book. Tonight our guest is Rick Kustich. Rick is a fly fishing author and photographer. In January 2013, he released Advanced Fly Fishing for Great Lake Steelhead, which was his fifth fishing title, and his most recent release is Hunting Muskie with a Fly. Rick has fly fished the Great Lakes for steelhead for over 30 years and finds that Great Lakes is his home turf, so to speak. His work has appeared in numerous national and regional publications, and he's also a fly tier, seminar speaker, and travel host, and has produced a fly tying DVD. Rick has also spent time as a fly shop owner, outfitter, and fly fishing book publisher. Rick began fly fishing almost 40 years ago on lakes and streams of upstate New York. He has since traveled extensively to experience the finest fly fishing throughout North America and beyond, but continues to find that some of the best fishing often exists in his own backyard. Rick spends a significant amount of time each year on the water and has developed a special passion for steelhead fishing and muskie fishing in the Great Lakes region. Rick, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hi, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you back.
Good to be back.
And, last time we talked about steelhead, I believe. And now we're switching gears pretty radically, in my mind, as far as the our prey here. So let's get right to it. We got lots of questions to cover. And muskie has been kind of an elusive, trophy for many years, long before fly fishing entered the world. I remember my uncle They called him, he was out of Chicago and fished northern Wisconsin and Canada, and they called him Muskie Bob. And he spent his whole life fishing for muskie, and that's all he would fish for. And he didn't catch that many. So tell us a little bit about the muskie and its general profile. And who is the muskie?
I think you started it out well. There is just a certain intrigue about muskie and a certain mystique that surrounds the fish. There have been many stories and legends about individuals that have kind of been bitten by the muskie bug and kind of have dedicated their entire life to their pursuit. But when I think of a muskie, I think of it, as a top of the food chain predator. And pretty much everywhere where it lived, it's on the top of the food chain, which gives it a certain, attitude and swagger that I think it portrays in pretty much everything that a muskie does. And I think that's really one of the things that, kind of that swagger is what attracts many anglers, to that fish. It's mystical. It's, a lot of mystique that surrounds it. So I think that's really what a muskie is. But again, I think of it as, the top predator in any given, any given river or lake. And I think as anglers, there's a certain attraction to us to kind of go after the top dog.
Yeah, there's not, I guess, predators for muskie are humans, and maybe when they're younger, hawks or eagles, I suppose. But do they have any other natural predators?
Just when they are young. I mean, certainly before they reach about a length of 8 to 10 inches, they can be, subject to predation by other, bass or pike. Generally, muskie don't coexist real well with pike because pike tend to spawn about a month or two earlier than muskies do and in the same areas. So a lot of times the muskie or the young of northern pike will prey on the young of the muskie because they're just going to be that much smaller in their first year of life.
I didn't know that. So if it's a musky lake, then don't be looking for pike, huh? I mean, as a general rule or vice versa?
And they do. There's areas where they sort of live in the same areas. But, I think you're going to find where populations of musky and pike are never going to be, at their top if they coexist. And I've seen that certainly in, my home river, where it seems like when the pike numbers are up, the musky numbers are down and vice versa.
I see. Okay. Where are they found? Are they just in North America, or are they found in Europe or Russia or anywhere else?
Yeah, muskie are just confined in North America. So they're just throughout. And basically it's more in the northern Midwest to northeastern part of the continent. Muskie were originally found in 12 states or provinces, essentially. But their original range did extend down as far south as North Carolina, even into northern Georgia. But over the last few years, probably last, 40, 50 years, there's been an expansion both naturally and through stocking programs. And so muskie populations can be found in now 26 states or provinces. So
well,
really
now we
expanded.
Have the hybrid too, right? The tiger muskie.
Exactly. So of the exactly. So of the 20, so when I refer to 26 states and provinces, that doesn't include the states that just have hybrid muskie programs, which are Colorado, Utah, New Mexico. I think even I'm not sure, but I think some parts of Montana. So there's another handful of states that have, these hybrid musky tiger programs.
Yeah. So the best places, what are some of the best states and provinces that are good for musky fishing?
Well, certainly, I think the mecca for musky fishing, and you alluded to it at the beginning of the show, but it's Wisconsin. You know, the Wisconsin as a state has more bodies of water than any other state or province, and I think it's somewhere in the over 600 range of rivers and streams and lakes that are host to muskie. So, and just in such a diverse, wide variety of water in Wisconsin. So it's certainly an area that is becoming very favorite of fly fishers too, because there's a good number of amount of water that can be easily covered through fly fishing and fly fishing techniques. So, but there's other states as well, or you know, to kind of look further north. Ontario has about 400 lakes and rivers that have musky populations. A good portion of those are naturally reproducing populations. So there's a tremendous, and there's some huge lakes and expansive areas in Ontario that have great musky fishing. So that's certainly another area. States like Minnesota, Michigan, even West Virginia have a host of number of, or have a good number of musky lakes and rivers. One of the things that I found too is that you can really extend your season by going further south, Tennessee and Virginia. You can find good fishing, you know, through December, January, even into February, at a time where, you know, in the northern area where I am in New York State, the seasons are closed and the water's frozen up. You know, I have the opportunity to kind of extend my season by heading further south. So There's really there's a host of areas. Minnesota, if I didn't mention that, I think it may have that have good solid populations. And then there's another number of other states that you know, like my state of New York and Pennsylvania, Ohio, that have a little more limited fisheries, but still can find some high quality.
Okay. Roy Fukushima in Orange, California wrote in and asked, he says, well, muskies are on my bucket list, however, I live in Orange, California. However, a friend of his lives adjacent to Lake Minnetonka, Minnesota. He's wondering if that's a good place to start looking for muskie, and wants to know about any suggestions or comments he would make about making arrangements for a trip to target muskie.
Yeah, certainly Minnesota has a high number of lakes and rivers that have muskie, so it would be a decent place to start. I certainly would think in terms of Wisconsin as a good starting place, a good place to catch your first muskie, just because of the densities and the populations. There is also a good handful of muskie guides that specialize in fly fishing in the Wisconsin area. I know there are a few in the Minnesota area as well. So what I would suggest is if you are trying to catch your first muskie on a fly, that you do, if you're going to use a guide, to find a guide that specializes in fly fishing, that is going to be committed to the act of fly fishing and the strategy, and be committed to it all day long. I think that's important. And somebody that can kind of coach a person through the the strategy and the presentation and the retrieves. That's one suggestion I would certainly make is, it's probably worth, contacting a guide, for the first, trip to that.
Yeah.
But I would certainly look at, Minnesota and Wisconsin both have, some dedicated guiding and some shots, fly shops that, specialize in muskie fishing.
Yeah, and I, as you said earlier, since they aren't in every lake, you definitely want to make sure you're on the right lake. I remember my other uncle who used to live up by Lac des Flambeaux in Wisconsin, and I remember there was a series of interconnecting lakes there, and he would say, "Oh, well, this is a musky lake, and that one's not." And even though they were interconnected, probably had something to do with what you were talking about earlier, with the pike. I think especially in the do-it-yourself situation, you'd want to make sure you're in the right place at the right time.
Absolutely. Let me just add to that, Roger. I think just the distribution of muskie is spotty in certain areas. And it's hard to figure out it sometimes. I mean, you can look at an area, and like you said, there can be natural populations of muskie in a certain lake, and then on a neighbor, I've seen that, you know, throughout the range, in a neighboring lake or river where you think looks good for muskie, and then, you know, they have never existed in that spot. So, I mean, their distribution is wide, but it can be spotty in certain areas.
Okay. What about any interesting history about muskie, you know, prior to the fly fishing times that you can share with us?
There's always been, like I said, you know, there's always been a certain lore associated with muskie fishing. I think a lot of it has to do with the size of the fish. I think anytime you go into an old tackle shop, old lodge, I mean, you can see old mounts from the, you know, whatever, 20s, 30s, 40s, old, you know, old photography of people holding muskies. So, I mean, there's a long history of chasing muskie, certainly. And I think, again, a lot of it has to do with the history of the fish. One of the things that I think I find interesting about their history, and it's, you know, in some cases sad, yeah, muskie can be pretty difficult to catch. I mean, you alluded to your uncle at the beginning of the show, and you know that he didn't catch a lot of them, and they can be difficult to catch. But being the top of the food chain predator, there's not always a huge population in any, you know, given waterway. And you know what happened in the, you know, in terms of a history, in the late 1800s, overfishing really was detrimental to a number of lakes throughout their natural range, lakes and rivers. And
is that like commercial fishing, you mean, or meat?
It was fishing, you know, obviously not netting, but, you know, fishing with, you know, a rod and reel. I think a lot of it was done to supply restaurants and things of that nature. And so the fish really just did get a lot of pressure. And unfortunately, there are just too many stories of populations that were wiped out by overfishing, and in some cases, you know, habitat, you know, destruction as well. So, you know, when you look at, you know, historically, there was huge populations probably at some point when the settlers came to North America. But boy, end of the 1800s and early 1900s, there's just too many accounts of muskie, you know, particularly lakes that have been wiped out. I think, you know, you just get to a point where, again, they're hard to catch, but they're still susceptible to catching. You reduce the population to too small of a number, and they just cannot, you know, reproduce that at the rate that's needed to maintain the population. So there was, you know, in some areas, hatcheries put in place that to help build up the populations. I think overall it's been a pretty good news story in that over the last probably 20 to 30 years, I think anglers, you know, professional managers have really valued the importance of muskie and muskie populations from a recreational fishery standpoint, and have really worked to rebuild populations. And I think a lot of it is self-controlled. You know, size limits have been raised consistently in most states and provinces. And there's a huge catch and release ethic, you know, among muskie anglers. You know, so I guess the good news part of that is that, you know, I got to believe that the opportunity to catch muskies now is probably as good as it, you know, was back in the 1800s before there was a lot of pressure on the fish.
Oh, that's good to hear. Well, kind of takes us fishermen and fisherwomen a while to learn that not an unending resource, right? And it's just like, well, maybe muskie will get that way at some point, like, you know, where in Belize, you know, the bonefish and tarpon and permit are all protected. That makes it sustainable. Otherwise, it won't be. So that's good to hear. That's good to hear that we're getting a comeback, and always happy to hear about that. Let's take a... one thing about the lore, one thing I remember as a kid is my uncle pulling out these musky lures. You know, he wasn't a fly fisherman. He was a, you know, a spin fisherman. And he would pull out these foot-long lures. And us kids would all, like, kind of get wide-eyed and drop our jaws and go, you know, there are fish that can eat that. You know?
Yeah.
I just remember that as a childhood memory, you know. That and my other uncle who carried around a small baseball bat in his boat.
Yeah.
So that if he had caught a muskie, then he could deal with the muskie before it got into the boat.
Yeah.
So childhood memories abound.
Well, I'll tell you one of mine, briefly, I talk about it a little bit in the introduction of the book. But my uncle was a member of a fishing club where I grew up on Grand Island, New York, right in the upper Niagara River, and that club still exists. It's one of the oldest fishing clubs in the country. And I always remember there was a muskie mount in there pretty large fish at the time. It was huge. It was probably a mid 40-inch fish or something along that line. And that was my initiation into what a muskie was. You know, was seeing this fish on the wall, and I was, you could see the teeth and the big mouth, and I was aghast when somebody said that those existed, right in the river, right out in front of us there. And that's always, from that moment, I was like, okay, I got to catch one of these things. This is too much, and I just couldn't believe. Fish of that size and that just looking so mean existed in the water that we swam in.
Yeah, it makes you not want to go swimming in the lake that afternoon.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about these top predators. So give me just a moment. We'll be right back.
Thanks,
Water Master is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Water Master Grizzly Kodiak Rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Water Master Rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kickboats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. That's BigSkyInflatables.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rick Kustich about hunting muskie with a fly. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Rick, I was asked, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So what have you been up to lately? Obviously, finishing a book is a big project.
Yeah, it was released in January. It certainly always feels good to get a project like that accomplished and behind me. I enjoyed writing, but, when you get to the end of the project, there's a lot of loose ends to pull together, and it's always good to put it behind me. I'm getting ready for my muskie season. Part of it has started here in New York State, and a portion of it will open in another 10 days. So I'm looking very forward to that part of it. But this year has been a rainy year here in Western New York. It kind of put a damper on our spring steelhead fishing. So I've spent a lot more time trout fishing this spring so far, and a bit of time smallmouth fishing. One of the things that I certainly am blessed with where I live is just the diversity of fishing that I kind of have at my doorstep.
Really? Yeah, you've got those huge browns up there in New York, right? The steelhead.
Yeah, we do, although, Canada. Yeah, we do have that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll say the brown trout fishing. Yeah, the brown trout fishing on Ontario is off of Lake Ontario is kind of on a little bit of a down trough right now, but they're working on some things to bring that back a bit. So just not everything can't be good at once. So that right now that's a little bit off, but I'm sure it'll come back.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good. Well, thanks for sharing that. So back to the muskies. Tell us a bit about the behavior of a muskie, and in relation, and maybe compare it to other fish like the pike, northern pike, since it's somewhat similar, right?
Yeah, muskie, I think, behave like really no other fish, at least in freshwater. They just have a very, it's just odd. I mean, you could have a fish that just attacks your fly on the very first strip, and you can have another fish that's going to follow it right to the boat, inspect it for, a few seconds, few minutes, it seems like, right next to the boat, and not eat it. They just, I can't just overemphasize enough the top of the food chain predator. They just don't feel, they don't feel pressure. They don't feel a sense of urgency a lot of times to eat. And so there's a lot of times where you have fish that follow your fly right to the boat on the retrieve. And that happens quite commonly. And it happens everywhere. And it's not necessarily a function of fish that gets, that are heavily pressured. It's just part of their nature. And it's not just even with fly fishing. It's, with conventional gear as well. You'll hear, conventional anglers talking about the same thing, fish following to the boat. So that behavior is different from almost everything, every other fish we fish for. And it also makes it very exciting that when you have a fish that follows your fly in, you can get that fish, if you employ certain techniques, you can get that fish to eat the fly. And, that's really what makes musky fishing one of the most exciting things, is to have a 3 to 4 foot fish right at the end of your rod tip, so visual right in front of you. And, I think that's really epitomizes a lot of times what we think about when we're fishing for them. I see, musky's behavior quite a bit different from a pike. Pike's generally a little more aggressive, when they take, a little bit easier to get to take a fly. You don't normally get the follows out of pike, or when you do, a lot of times they eat without having to be teased too much. So I see northern pike being, quite a bit more aggressive and, a bit easier to catch than a muskie.
Okay. Now, their behavior in the water, do you find them sitting and waiting in structure, or are they cruising, or what is their preparation for attack?
Yeah, I would say a lot of times a muskie utilizes a piece of structure for an ambush spot. One thing that, really that drives a muskie is that it needs to feed to maintain, its size and its body weight. So food certainly, available food source certainly drives a muskie's positioning and drives a lot of what a muskie does. Especially when you get away from, the spawning, obviously spawning is going to drive pretty much, any fish. But once you get away from that, pretty much food is going to be one of the things that, that muskie are going to equate to. But also, structure. And structure usually either is, such things as weed beds, where there is going to be an available food source. Kind of all levels of the food chain can be found in a weed bed. Muskies can kind of be near that, and at the same time kind of use the structure of weeds to hide and, use that for camouflage so that they can ambush. And they use some, structure that's, a little bit, more distinct, like log jams and things like that, particularly in rivers. So there might not be food nearby, but they'll be using that particular structure to be able to ambush something that does happen to come by or swim by or float by or whatever. So, that certainly their positioning, they do use structure quite a bit. There are going to be times where they'll be cruising around, especially in search of food, especially in lakes or rivers that don't have a lot of current. But for the most part, as an angler, you think about musky structure and targeting structure, and areas where there's going to be available food.
Okay, okay. Phil in Kentucky asks, are muskies territorial to the extent that one is unlikely to find more than one muskie in the same general location?
I would say they are territorial, particularly a larger fish. I think one thing I've noted is that muskies, especially larger muskies, are similar to brown trout in that, you know, a big brown trout's going to figure out a way to occupy the best feeding spot, you know, in a pool or in a run. I think a big muskie tends to do that as well. You know, it's going to find its most favored spot and be able to muscle its way in. So from that standpoint, you know, they are going to be a bit territorial, and those bigger fish might be more loners. But I've seen, you know, numerous situations where if the conditions are right and there's, you know, good structure, good weed beds, there's a lot of bait in an area, it can attract, you know, a number of muskies so that you can, you know, I wouldn't say there'd be a school of muskies, but where you could certainly have multiple individuals in a pretty small area. Again, particularly if, you know, if that feeding condition is right. So it's a little of each. You know, it's a little of each. You're going to find fish that are territorial where you're going to just find one fish here, one fish there. That's pretty common. But when the conditions are right, it can attract a, you know, multiple fish in a small area.
Okay. Let's switch gears for a few minutes, and we'll come back to more strategies and tactics later on. But let's talk about equipment. What about rod? What kind of weight and what type of rod do you recommend for muskies?
I generally use a 10-weight rod. I know some anglers that use 11 weights, and even a few anglers that, you know, hook some big flies that use 12 weights. For me, a 10-weight's just about right. You know, I think it's light enough that I can generally cast it all day long and not feel too fatigued, but it's clearly large enough, from at least far as I'm concerned, to, you know, fight a fish of 50 inches. But I have to say between a 10 and 11 would be the right weight rod. I prefer a 9-footer, you know, in terms of just being able to make the cast and control it around the boat. I like a rod that, you know, kind of a medium to fast action. You know, I like a little bit slower action for, you know, launching the cast. But it needs to be, you know, fast and responsive enough that when I'm doing a figure eight near the boat, that it can turn the fly and make it behave the way I want it. So I'd say kind of a medium fast action. And that's pretty much, you know, what I use. You know, I do have a few friends of mine that like to use, you know, switch rods and even two-handed rods for casting for muskie. And even, you know, they overhand cast them. But it certainly takes away from the fatigue factor when you're using a two-hander all day long, as opposed. And those rods are generally going to be about 10.5, 11 feet long. And a little cumbersome for working near the boat, but there might be an advantage to that, too, because they stick down into the water deeper, and when you're doing a figure eight, it keeps the fly a little further away from the boat.
Yeah, yeah. We'll come back to that figure eight later. I know there's a question about that. I have memories of that one, too. So what about lines? Are you using primarily floating lines, or are you using sinking tips, both? What's the best bet there?
Yeah, I mean, if you're trying to build a tackle base for musky fishing, I would say having a sink tip line and a floater, you know, on different reels is probably the best way to go. I use a sink tip most of the time, or at least a large portion of my fishing. So what I usually rig with is like a 400 or even a 500 grain line. Almost every line manufacturer now makes one that, you know, with about a 24 to 30 foot sink section, and that usually has a shorter back rear taper to a running line. So the advantage of that type of a line, and I think a lot of musky anglers are using this, the advantage of that type of line is you can carry about, oh, maybe 40 feet of line in the air, and easily shoot another 30 to 40 feet and quickly make, you know, the longer 70, 80 foot cast that, you know, that a lot of the water requires. So that's my go-to line. It's a 400 or 500 grain sink tip, you know, 24 or 30 foot length.
Okay, and we also had questions from Dan in Embingden, Illinois, and Ted Hasselbring in Nashville, Tennessee, both asking about how you rig your terminal tackle. So what kind of leader are you using? And it looks like we have coming up here another question on bite guards. So
okay.
How do you set up your leader?
Yeah, so let's you can ask, you know, 30 musky fly fishermen how they set up their leaders, and you probably get a different answer from everyone. But here's mine, and, you know, the one I've kind of settled on, and it's a really a simple leader arrangement, and I think it works, you know, very well for me. But I'm just using a straight piece of 30-pound fluorocarbon, you know, for my main leader. It's usually going to be about six to seven feet long, even on the sink tip. And then I'm going to have a bite guard attached to that. And, you know, what I've been doing, this is one way to do it. And there's I'll have a couple other ideas here. But what I do is a loop-to-loop connection between my bite guard and my fluorocarbon. So I'm using my piece of fluorocarbon. I tie a perfection loop at the end of each, at both ends. Loop one to the fly line, and then I have a perfection loop going to the bite tippet. I tie but the perfection loop at the end going to the bite tippet is a larger perfection loop so that I can keep my bite tippet attached to my fly and just change. Anytime I want to make a change, I can just do a loop-to-loop connection. The loop on the end of the leader is large enough that it can go over a fly and makes for a very quick change. So I don't have to actually tie knots. I don't have to make my bite guard shorter by changing flies. But that's very simple, and it works very well. And I'm just using a four-turn clinch knot to my fly with the bite guard. What I use for a bite guard is just knotable wire. So just like either like a 7-strand wire coated with nylon that you're able to tie knots with. And that really, I think, it works out very well. Another, you know, way to do that is to attach your, you can attach your bite guard right to the fluorocarbon and use a snap swivel, a heavy snap swivel at the end of the bite guard. And that way it facilitates easy changes of the flies as well without having to change the length of your bite guard. And, yeah, the bite guard length is kind of an important part of the technique with the figure eight, and I'll talk about that as, you know, kind of as we get into that.
Okay.
So that's my basic setup. Very simple, works out well. There's many variations to that. But I like the simplicity of that approach, and it, like I said, it seems to be very effective.
And Jeff in Minnesota is asking about bite guards. He says, I've tried the tieable bite guards, but they don't seem to hold shape and become a bizarre spring after a while. Are you sold on a particular tieable bite guard, or do you stick with fluorocarbon? So you just said when he says tieable bite guards, is he talking about wire, do you think, or?
Yeah. So that would be just, you know, the flexible, the knotable wire. And, the American Fishing Wires makes a real good product. I've been using Tiger Wire the last couple of years. You know, both of them do work well. I know what he's talking about. Sometimes you kind of just get a little, you know, squirrel tail, you know, towards the fly that kind of just, you know, doesn't look nice and straight. You know, generally when I get that, I'll just snip that piece off and tie another piece on. I think a lot of that has to do with when you tie the knot, it just twists it a little bit. So, you know, that's really the only thing. It's probably one of the downsides of that, of using the wire. But, you know, generally it lasts quite a while without having to, before it kind of gets that little curly in there. But, like I said, I usually just kind of cut that out and retie when that occurs. I tend to stay away from fluorocarbon. I used it for a while. I do think it provides a little more stealth, but I will say that pretty much everybody that, has used it for a long enough period of time has stories of getting bitten off. And, a lot of times it's, a large fish, and I really hate leaving a fly in a fish. So, for the most part, I've moved away from it. I will say that I have a good friend of mine, Joe Goodspeed, who swears by fluorocarbon. And in his mind, the key is not the fluorocarbon itself, or not just that it's 80-pound fluorocarbon. His research tells him that you have to use very hard fluorocarbon. So generally the stuff that knots easily is softer, and it might be 80 pound, but it's going to be cut more easily than 80 pound that is very stiff and hard and much more difficult to work with or not, but it'll be also a lot more difficult to cut through. So he's had tremendous success with that, and no bite offs. So that's the thing to keep in mind. If you're convinced you want to use fluorocarbon, try to use something with a much harder base. But for the most part, I just never use it anymore because I just don't want to take a chance to add a bite off.
Yeah. One more question before we take a break, and then we'll come back talk about food and flies and strategies. What about reels? Anything specific? Do you need a lot of backing? Do you get long runs out of muskies? Or what do you need to look out for there?
Generally not. My recommendation is if you have a budget for equipment for muskie, I would not spend, an overabundance on a muskie reel. Quite honestly, there's a lot of times where I play the fish with it never getting to the reel, or most of the time. I'll have enough line stripped out. I'm retrieving the fly, and when I hook the fish, I'm just going to play them, by stripping in line, behind the rod hand, just like you would be, retrieving the fly. Most of the time, that's how I fight a fish, even some of the bigger ones. Thing about muskie is, they have quick closing speed when they're feeding. But they don't have, when you fight one, it's usually toe-to-toe. They'll run some, but not often will they run out a lot of line, even the bigger fish. There'll just be a tendency to kind of go toe-to-toe. They have their tricks for trying to throw the hook, but one of them is trying to run, 100 or 200 yards for the most part. So sometimes, there are times where you will get one on a reel. So you want a reel that does have capacity to just in those situations to handle, say 150 yards of backing. And you do want one that has, at least a fairly smooth disc drag. So if it does get on the reel and take a line that, it has to, fight to get some of that line. But for the most part, there'll just be a lot of times where you'll never get the fly, you'll never get the fish to the reel.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back and talk more about hunting muskie with a fly. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk weight and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Rick Kustich about hunting muskie with a fly. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And so with that, let's move on to food and flies, Rick. So I assume the muskies eat a lot of meat, right? No vegetarians in this group,
yeah.
Right?
No, they're definitely meat eaters.
And so they're probably mainly bait fish and so forth. Is that what they primarily feed on?
I guess, if someone was to ask what do muskie eat, I think you could probably answer by saying what don't muskie eat that's in the water. I think really anything that's in the water is fair game. I mean, that's pretty much been proven, beyond bait fish. I mean, frogs, snakes, ducks, birds, really anything that's in the water and, making some movement and looking vulnerable is fair game. But, yeah, for the most part, just a wider range of bait fish, and it certainly varies by body of water. But fatty, high-protein fish, certainly perch, all different types of shiners, suckers, ciscos, that really make up a good abundance of what muskies tend to eat. So it's important, I think, to a degree, to learn a little bit about the forage base in the rivers or lakes that you do that you're going to target, just to kind of have an idea of those fish's habits, where they can be found at different times of the year. Can help you construct the color palette of your flies and things of that nature. So it is good to have kind of that background, but it really varies by body of water.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how often do they feed? Are they looking for food most all the time, or do they fill up and sit there for a day or two and not feed?
My feeling is that muskie's metabolism is at its highest in the summertime. So they need, when the water temperature is high, they need to eat the most. So they're going to be feeding, more often and in that time frame. And then as you go through the fall, while their metabolism may slow down a bit, they still, particularly, females are going to be eating very well to try to build up their body weight for the winter time and be ready for the spawn in the spring. So, I think there's a time frame there, summer and fall, where they're going to be a little more active from a feeding standpoint. In terms of how much they feed, I think it just really has to do with how large of a meal they've eaten. I mean, we use, obviously, flies that are 10 to 12 inches long. They're eating stuff that is 10 to 12 inches long. Even the biggest fish can only eat so much stuff that's 10 to 12 inches long in a day. I think that really dictates a lot of times how aggressive they are towards your fly. I mean, that's my feeling. A lot of times it's just kind of finding that fish that's in the right mood. I don't know what exactly tells a muskie that it's hungry. I got to believe there's just some type of biological trigger that they understand that it's time to feed, that I don't think they feel hunger like you and I do, but I do think that that's what a lot of times it's with muskie. It's just getting a fly in front of a fish at the right time when it's aggressive. I think getting a fly in front of a fish that just ate a 10-inch sucker or 12-inch sucker, well, you're probably not going to get, not going to interest that fish. But, later in the day or the next day, a couple of days after it ate that large, it's going to be more, be more aggressive. So,
I'm thinking about their behavior compared to pike and so forth, and I know I've caught pike, that still have a tail sticking out of their mouth from the meal that they just got. They haven't even swallowed the whole thing, and they're hitting on another lure. So I didn't know if muskie were that aggressive as pike or tend not. Have you seen that happen with muskie?
I have seen it happen, but I don't see it happen as often is, I've seen it happen once or twice where there was, a visible, meal still in the muskie's gullet. But for the most part, I don't see that. So I kind of tend to think they eat something and then they kind of sulk for a bit.
Yeah.
Kind of how I think of it.
Yeah.
Then they'll go and get something else. I think the one thing about muskie is, that's what it's interesting about a muskie is to a degree, that's how they act in the water. Like, they feel like they can pretty much find something anytime they want to type of a situation. So I don't think there's always an urgency. So I think they kind of eat at their own pace.
Yeah, yeah. Both Ted in Nashville, Tennessee, and Bill in Boulder Junction, Wisconsin, asked about, what are your favorite muskie fly patterns? And Bill threw in a why as well. Why are these patterns your favorites?
Certainly, again, you talk to various muskie fishermen, and they're going to give you, various answers on flies. One of my go-to flies, it's in the book. It's, one I call a ham bone. It's patterned mainly after, some of the innovations that Blaine Chocolate has come up with flies. I mean, his designs really kind of, revolutionized and changed, the way we think about musky flies as far as I'm concerned. But, this particular pattern is just a series of, two hooks or one hook, a handful of shanks, shorter shanks that allow the fly to get a lot of movement. I mean, it's tied with saddle hackle at the tail, some saddle hackle over the top, and just basically, reverse tied bucktail, throughout the shanks, with a fair amount of flash tied in throughout. So really it's just it's kind of, again, a pattern after, Blaine Chocolate's T-bone. But what I like about that fly is it's fairly easy to tie with the shanks. And what I use either, a deer hair head, or I also use, Flyman's fish skull heads. And, what I like about the fly is with a real distinct and snappy type of strip, it really kind of kicks from side to side and really gives the fly a good broadside view to the fish. Makes the fly look like it's a fish that's in distress or one that's having some troubles. Makes it vulnerable to the muskie. Mm-hmm. So that's really been my go-to is just, kind of a bucktail saddle hackle type of arrangement. I know other anglers are, certainly tying similar types of flies with synthetics and things like that to make them a little bit lighter. But, I found this kind of a fly pattern to work well for me. But, again, you can go in totally different directions. I'll bring up my friend Joe Goodspeed again. His idea is to use flies with, either real flat heads or bulky heads where he uses goop to form the head. And these flies also provide a very erratic action, but without the real distinct, snappy type of strip. He's able to use just a very slow kind of, just deliberate strip, and it also kicks that fly from side to side. So there's some different designs out there that kind of get the same type of reaction or action, and it's really trying to make that fly look vulnerable or look like it's in distress.
Yeah, yeah. I like some of these names, and here are some of the flies in your book. One half chicken dinner, and then instead of ham bone, we got the T-bone, and
yeah.
all indication of big meals happening here.
Yeah, and the T-bone actually, I'll just that really is my ham bone is really the T-bone was originated by Blaine, and the idea of that isn't really. It's not a T-bone like a T-bone steak. It's a T-bone in that fly kind of kicks from side to side, giving the fish a side view of the fly so that when it takes the fly, it T-bones it, more in to kind of like a T-bone accident where it's, taking it on a broadside basis.
Yeah.
And that's really one of Blaine's, major contributions to the musky game is, that fly and that concept.
Good, good. We had Alan Rupp in Beach Park, Illinois, write in and say, he says, why does it appear that all the flies created in the upper Midwest try to push the envelope on how wind-resistant a fly can be? Yet, Blaine Chocolate's Game Changer instead looks for action.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, from that question, I think I understand it, but, you know, so I'm just wondering if the question is referring to how trying to reduce the wind resistance on the fly or making it, you know, greater wind resistance.
No, I think he's saying that a lot of them are huge and bulky and wind resistant, which make them hard to cast, but Blaine's are, rather than bulk, are more interested in action. I think that's where he's going.
Yeah, and that's certainly you know, what he has gone for is that idea of having a lot of movement in the water, making the fly look vulnerable. And I think that is you know, that's been effective. But there's certainly, you know, a number of other types of flies, those that aren't tied in that same manner. There's a number that you know, that Brad Bowen has tied that aren't tied on shanks. They're tied on just single hooks, and where he tries to keep the bulk of the fly down. So it's not one that has that same, you know, kind of serpentine action that you're going to get out of Blaine's Game Changer, which is really a long series of shanks. Could have as many as six shanks in it. You know, Brad's flies are generally going to get some movement because they're going to have a big head on them, a big trimmed deer hair head. And, you know, those flies they look big in the water even though they don't have a lot of material on them. And that's, you know, if you're not going to tie, like, a fly that has, you know, the shanks in them, those types, like, you know, that Brad is tying with, you know, he's making the fly look a lot bigger than it really is, you know, through the materials that he's using. So one thing about that fly is it's, you know, kind of cuts down on the wind resistance. And to me, wind resistance is a huge deal. You know, if you're casting a big fly all day long, you know, you get towards the end of, you know, I look at it when I'm casting a fly rod, I'm a bit like a, you know, a major league pitcher. I only really have so many good casts in me during the course of the day. You're going to wear down towards the end of the day. And a lot of times I'll be picking a fly that has less wind resistance in it, even if it's a bit smaller and you know, and doesn't have the same big profile, just so that I can continue to make good casts, you know, all throughout the 8 or 10 hours that I'm going to be out on the water.
Yeah, that was a question that came up later that I maybe you can just expand upon, is how to avoid fatigue,
yeah,
these big rods and flies and lines. Tips on that?
I think it's just, you know, really just trying to pace yourself, you know, trying to make the rod work for yourself. You know, the one thing is that, you know, the rod's a great lever and a great tool, and I think you have to learn how to cast efficiently and effectively and not, you know, let your body bear too much of the burden of casting all day long and make sure that you're, you know, using the rod, you know, the best you can. I say also practice so that you can try to get as efficient as possible with your casting and get it as proficient as possible as well. You know, some of the other things that I, you know, stay in shape. You know, I make regular trips to the gym. You know, part of that is so that I can, you know, withstand long days out on the boat and certainly stay hydrated and eat, you know, during the course of the day. Sometimes it's hard when you're fishing, especially musky fishing. You want to just keep casting. You want to have your fly in the water all the time. But take some energy snacks and things of that nature. You know, keep yourself fueled. You know, you're burning calories out there doing it. Make sure you drink and stay fueled. And I think all those types of things add up towards the end of the day.
Okay. What about, I know in your book you talk a little bit about moon phases. Are musky affected by phases of the moon?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel, you know, strongly about, you know, moon phases. One of the things that I observe the most is that muskies tend to be quite active on a new moon. You know, so when I think you got that dark of the moon, it just seems like they're more active during the day and really just at that time frame. I do think that you can get numerous answers. I think in general that's a pretty constant among muskie anglers that a new moon. And what I really try, if I'm going to take a 2 or 3 day trip somewhere, I do try to time it around that period. And I make sure that, you know, even on my local waters, I try to fish almost every new moon during the course of the year, during the course of the season. On the flip side, the full moon also is a time of increased activity. You'll get numerous responses from muskie anglers. You know, some hate the new moon or some hate a full moon. Others, really try to utilize that. I think what a full moon does is it kind of just gets everything a little bit more energized. You know, there's a light during a longer period of time. You know, if you got a full moon and a clear night, the fish can feed at night, but I also think it just stirs up the bait and it just kind of brings everything, alive. But, you know, what I've also found is that, I think because fish can feed during the night, the daytime, especially the morning time or, low light times that I really like, tend to not be as good, during the full moon period. But the middle of the day tends to be a little bit better during a full moon. One of the things that I've really noticed with the moon phases as well, though, isn't even just the phases themselves, but is the daily rises and sets of the moon. When I can get, a situation where particularly, really at any time, and really it's just been so obvious, particularly on my home water, that hour, maybe 45 minutes to an hour on either side of a moon rise or a moon set, there just seems to be an increase in activity of muskies. I can't explain exactly what that is, but it's become fairly consistent. And again, I try to be on my best spots when I'm near within that hour period of a moon rise or a moon set.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Do you have much luck catching muskies, at the twilight hours, early morning hours? Do they tend to feed better there, like a big brown trout would, than midday? Or does it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it does. That hour, that first hour of the day, last hour of the day, definitely. I think that brings about that, ability to stalk. They're a little bit more comfortable out, particularly on water that gets, a fair amount of traffic or, recreational traffic. Yeah, definitely. It always makes sense to be out in the water, at first light or last light if you can be. And if you can kind of combine those two, combine that with a moon rise or a moon set, you can really, really have the right conditions.
Right, right. Lynn from Maryland asked, can you achieve a similar level of success with flies compared to fishing for muskies with hardware or bait? Is it still 10,000 casts?
Yeah, sometimes it even seems like more. I think, there's times where you can, attain a similar success rate. And I think there's even times where, because of the stealth factor, because of the, just kind of it being a change of pace, a bit of a curveball, I can see where sometimes fly fishing for muskies can even be more effective. And I've seen it, I've seen it firsthand. But I think just generally the one disadvantage you have as a fly fisherman is just can't cover as much water and types of water as effectively, with a fly that you can with hardware, particularly conventional gear. Or, it's always hard to compete with bait, when you're talking about a fly and real bait. But I think there's times where fly fishing can do, similarly or even a little bit better. But, on an overall basis, day-to-day, it's pretty hard to compete with conventional gear. So I think you're always going to know that you're at a little bit of a handicap with that.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have more success fishing from a boat or from the shore?
I like fishing from a boat for muskie. Just opens up a lot more water. You know, the type of water I fish is generally larger. There are, you know, certainly opportunities from shore, particularly on, you know, smaller rivers and, you know, even some creeks and things like that. So, I mean, you know, if you don't have a boat, wading or, you know, fishing along banks, there's plenty of opportunity for that as well. But I just like to have a boat. I like to be able to move around and, hit a various, you know, variety of different types of structure. It's not like a boat has to be an expensive, you know, piece of equipment. I know a number of anglers that have kind of converted, you know, relatively cheap crafts into, you know, musky machines. So it, you know, really doesn't have to be a huge outlay of money to have a boat. And a lot of anglers are fishing out of kayaks and, other types of kind of personal flotation boats as well. So there's a lot of different options out there for sure.
So, you know, when you go, out looking for muskies, hunting for muskies, what are you looking for as far as the habitat out there? You know, let's say it's a lake you haven't been on, you don't know all the secret spots. Where do you start?
I always like weed beds. I always just think that's, a good starting point on any type of new water. Find the weed edges. There's just usually going to be a good cross section of the food chain, you know, in and near the weeds. So that's certainly one thing that I look for. I look for, you know, structural elements in terms of change in bottom. So, points that are sticking out, dramatic drop offs, those types of structure points where a fish can, kind of set up an ambush where bait has to move around it or come up a certain area. So I'm also looking for that type of thing. But, and then when I move to, so river, larger rivers and lakes, I really focus on weeds and the points and change in depth and things like that. When you get into rivers, it's really a wider range of different types of structure. And, there I'm looking for, log jams and, timber in the water and breaks in the current, either caused by back eddies or, downsides of islands and things of that nature. But anytime you're fishing rivers, I look for softness, in the current, just getting out of the main current. Muskies kind of try to rest off to the sides, even boulders and things like that, deep, slow pools, places where they don't have to fight the current.
Okay. Good. And do you find better musky fishing in lakes or rivers?
From my standpoint, honestly, it's a bit of a cop-out, but I really do like fishing both. I like the challenge of big open water and, trying to, there just is that challenge that's, big open water sometimes intimidating, and I really like the idea of trying to break it down into smaller pieces based on, my knowledge or what I'm learning or what I'm identifying as structure in the lake. But I think generally if for fly anglers that, let's say you've trout fished or you've smallmouth fished or whatever on rivers, I think it's easier if you're going out after your muskie for a first time or you're doing this, you're trying to kind of, move into muskie fishing. I think a lot of fly anglers would adapt to rivers easier. Just from the standpoint that, you're using a lot of the same structure or you kind of have that mindset to look for the obvious structure in a river or a stream.
Right.
And I think that makes that transition a little bit easier. So from that standpoint, for myself, I like fishing at all. I really do. I really like, the challenge of all the different water. But I do think if you're getting into musky fishing for the first time that transition may be a bit easier if you focus on rivers.
Yeah. Okay. And I remember that too. Not that this was a musky river, but, you know, we fished for a lot of pike, and I think they kind of sit in similar areas. But fished when I was a kid, Menominee River up in Wisconsin, between Wisconsin
okay.
and Michigan. And that was a big river, but it's just like you say, you can see those structure areas, those eddies and those logs and the weed beds and these little side kind of channels and stuff where they lay up. And, it's a little bit easier, I think, to pick those spots out, just as it is for trout, you know, where they might
get.
Let's see here. We have, and I think you've kind of addressed this, but I'll throw it out there again. Phil in Kentucky asked, have you been able to increase your chances of catching a muskie by learning the life cycles of the forage species muskies take advantage of? Can you find major bait fish concentrations on the water you fish?
Yeah, and I think we did touch upon that, but, you know, and it's really a good question. But, yes, I mean, there's no question. You know, learn something about the habits of the bait. You know, first learn about the bait that you have in the water that you're targeting. Learn about their habits. And certainly if you can, I mean, one of my biggest things, if you can find where the bait lives, the muskie knows where the bait lives. They're not going to be far behind. And that's certainly one way to locate it, particularly for me, particularly in the fall when the weeds start breaking away and the bait needs to start migrating either for spawning purposes or to find new structure. The muskies are going to be moving. And they're going to be finding that bait too. So if you can find it, you're certainly going to be close to muskies for sure.
Yeah, I remember fishing Lake Kississing up in northern Manitoba, and we were fishing for pike, but we were with a guide, and a storm was coming in, and there was some winds pushing the water, and he immediately motored up the boat. We went into this bay that he knew about, and we got back in that bay, and evidently the wind pushes the bait fish into the bay.
Yeah,
and it just. The pike started going crazy. It was like popcorn. The bait fish were popping out of the water, you know, because they were being chased underneath. And it was really an exciting half an hour, I'll tell you. But that wind had pushed that bait fish up. So like you say, if you know things like that are happening, and this guy did, you know, it really made all the difference for locating the fish.
Absolutely. Yep. No question about it.
So you had you talked about casting skills. I think we've kind of gone over that. You said you did in kind of just passing by said you might have to make 60, 80-foot casts. Do you find that often? Is that, norm rather?
Again, it all depends on, you know, the water that you're fishing. So if I'm fishing big open water of a lake or a big river, like my home river, and you're fishing the fly down 10, 12 feet, 14 feet, you know, the longer the cast you can make, the longer that fly is going to be down in that deeper strike zone. So yes, I like to, you know, consistently make those types of casts, I think with, even just a bit of instruction, a bit of practice, intermediate caster can do that pretty much all day long with the right rod and the right lines. You know, the key is just, creating a nice tight loop with the line, certainly learning how to do a double haul. So that's critical for that type of fishing. But I will say that, you know, when you're fishing a small, intimate river, yeah, you may not be making 60, 80-foot casts. A lot of those casts might be 40 to 50 feet. And then accuracy a lot of times becomes a lot more important than distance. You want to drop a fly near, a log jam or something like that and, be able to get it into that area where you think a muskie's going to be.
Yeah, it brings up the question of do you do more blind casting or more sight fishing?
Yeah, certainly a high percentage of blind casting to structure, either visible structure or structure that you know exists based on what you're finding on your electronics, but it's usually visible structure in one way or another. So yes, it's almost all blind casting. I do have a number of opportunities early in the season, like when my season opens in a week and a half. Fish that'll be just coming off the spawn. A lot of times they'll still be in sandy bays and sandy flats and things like that, 4 or 5 feet deep. So we'll have the opportunity to visually see some fish and cast to them. And I think that occurs on a lot of places, you know, a lot of places where muskies live. You know, they kind of start the year out in pretty shallow water, but then they'll get deeper as the year goes on. So you might have there's a small window usually at the beginning of the year where you can do some sight casting, and I love doing that, but, you know, it really doesn't usually last too long. So it's mainly the blind casting. You know, blind casting the structure is pretty much the game.
Okay. What about retrieves? Can you tell us about some of the different retrieves you use and you know, when you might switch it up?
Yeah, my basic retrieve is just, you know, kind of a fast, snappy type of retrieve that makes that fly kind of kick from side to side. I like to let that fly just kind of sit for a second. So usually I let it, you know, strip it. You get that kick, let it sit for a second. A lot of times a fish will grab it, you know, kind of when it's at that pause. But that's what I like to do. It's kind of a snappy, you know, fairly quick retrieve. You know, when I, you know, so my retrieve would generally be a little bit faster when it's in the summertime. And I'll slow that down a bit more when I get to the late fall or even into the early winter. In the northern areas here. So as that water temperature kind of drops into the mid to low 40s, I really slow my retrieve down and kind of just give it a very slow, deliberate retrieve. But, you know, and I think it makes sense to mix it up and try to find what works best. But a lot of times the retrieve itself is what's providing a good amount of the action to the fly.
Yeah. Ron, and I'm trying to move fast here to cram all these in at the end here. Ron in Northeast Ohio says, over the past couple of seasons, the percentage of follows versus strikes have increased significantly for me. This may have be contributed to by the increased popularity of chasing muskies in my local waters, particularly on the fly. How do you read a following muskie to determine the best boat side maneuver to use to convert the follow into a strike? I've caught several muskies while performing the figure eight maneuver, but many more I did not convert. Looking for any insight you might have on how to read a muskie to determine the maneuver you use with respect to the pattern, maneuver, figure eight, circle, speed, depth, etc. So,
yeah, I mean, the idea with the figure eight is to, you know, when you have a fish following, to try to continue that follow and change directions and give the fish a different look at the fly. I think, you know, a lot of times you can intrigue a fish into kind of taking the fly if you kind of show it to it at a side angle, you know, kind of get that T-bone effect. A few things I'll say is you'll never convert all the follows that you get. So, you know, to Ron, don't feel bad about that. I mean, it's, it can get frustrating at times. So if you're converting a percentage of those, you're certainly doing well. What I try to do, yes, in terms of trying to read them, if you have a fish that's kind of following right behind the fly, a lot of times as that fish comes into view, I won't slow the fly down, but I'll pop it a little bit as he's right on the fly. If you can see the fish far enough away. And, you know, kind of try to tease it a little bit with a couple of tweaks like that. And then just kind of really start to continue to speed it up each strip, speed it up, and then kind of speed into my figure eight. You know, that idea that the fly is getting away from the fish, you know, tends to be pretty, fairly effective anyways. The one thing that, I try to do with my figure eights is make wide turns, and I don't necessarily even do a figure eight all the time. A lot of times I'll just do a big oval. So that allows me to really kind of get a bigger turn, and particularly with a bigger fish, to allow that fish to follow the fly better. You know, my friend, again, I'll go to my friend Joe Goodspeed. He doesn't ever do a figure eight. He likes to just tease the fish. So when they're coming in and he sees a fish, he almost slows his fly down. And he kind of just teases them with that bulbous head fly that he has, and it just goes from side to side. And quite honestly, that's been fairly effective for him, and something to try. I never like slowing it down, but just using a continual tease can work from time to time. But I'm pretty much go to the figure eight. I like to try to engage the fish so that he doesn't notice the boat, and really try to kind of, you know, so my main move again is to make a couple teasing movements with the fly if I have a follower, and then just try to continue to increase the speed and roll right into a figure eight.
Now, when you, I'm familiar with doing a figure eight with, you know, like a spinning rod. That's a little bit stiff, you know. And there my uncle, and by the way, when my uncle was always pulling my leg, so the first time he told me about that, I thought he was just pulling my leg, you know, do this figure eight. And I learned that he wasn't. but how do you do that with a fly rod? Because, you know, you've got a much longer rod. Physically, how do you manage that?
Well, I'll tell you, when I'm stripping my fly in, I always have the tip of the rod in the water. And really what that does is it helps me that if a fish does take the fly at any time during the retrieve, I want to make a nice heavy strip set when I set the fly on the fish. You know, muskies have, you know, bony cartilage mouths, and the best way to kind of bury that hook is to do a heavy strip set. I don't really want to do the set with the rod, at least, to, you know, unless it's, you know, a close-in situation. So I always have the tip of the rod in the water. So when I'm stripping my fly back, when I get to the point, what I do is I strip my fly all the way back to the knot between my fluorocarbon leader and my bite guard. So there's about 18 inches there. I strip it all the way back to that knot so I can really get a full turn with the figure eight. So I'm grabbing the line with my left hand, my line hand, right on, and grab the butt of the rod, and I'm grabbing the handle of the rod with my right hand, and I'm using both hands to do the figure eight and trying to get the rod tip as deep as possible so that the fly stays away from the boat. So okay. I'm sticking that rod tip probably down about 3 or 4 feet.
Okay. So that's, yeah, same way I was taught. And the other trick that my uncle told me is I saw a muskie come, you know, do the follow. I'm doing the figure eight, and the muskie just goes right past and under the boat. And my uncle said, "Keep doing it, keep doing it." He's probably sitting underneath the boat right now.
Yeah.
And so that was something I learned as a little tip as well. That they just looked at the boat as a little shelter, and many times would take another look. So.
No, that's absolutely true. And I'll do. Yeah, when I get a fish follow, even if he goes away, I continue to do the figure eight. Sometimes they'll come back. And usually even at, I do a figure eight at the end of every retrieve, whether I see a fish or not, because sometimes they're following deep and you don't see them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I usually do a good 3 or 4 rotations because sometimes it takes that much to be able to get the fish to come into view.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Rick, we're out of time. Still have a few more questions, but, and thanks, folks, for sending those in. But we always run out of time on the show. There's always too much to talk about.
And it's always too
much fun. Yeah. So, let's stick with me, Rick, here, because we're going to give away your book, and I'm going to use your help on that. We've got a few more things to cover, give a few prizes away. So everybody stick with me a few more minutes, and we'll get these prizes handed out and close it off for tonight. So we will be giving away 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a 1-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and then, of course, Rick's latest book, Hunting Muskie with a Fly, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So stick with me a couple more minutes, and we'll do just that. Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may be also at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org, and you can learn where you'll learn more about how to get involved. Again, it's SaveBristolBay.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website, tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link. Leave your comments. We really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show, because you don't want to miss out on some of these prizes. So if you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with the information on how to receive your gift. So the first thing we're going to do is give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to find out more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. You'll learn all about the organization, and you can join there if you don't win tonight. So I'll fire up my database here, and we get our first winner. First winner is Thomas Melville in New York. Thomas Melville. So, Thomas, congratulations on winning that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Second drawing will be for a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at ammottobooks.com. And they have all kinds of different books on fly fishing as well as periodicals, so be sure to check them out. Our winner for that is Paul Sammons. Paul Sammons in Texas. So congratulations, Paul, and on that one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. Okay, great. Now it's time to give away Rick's book, Hunting Muskie with a Fly. Beautiful book, and lots of big fish in this book, I'll tell you. I don't even know how some of these guys get these fish up for the picture. Seems like a miracle in itself. Some huge monsters in there and all kinds of great tactics and strategies, as Rick just touched upon tonight. So you'll be sure you want to get that book. Again, you can probably get that on Amazon or from Stackpole. So check it out. Again, Hunting Muskie with a Fly. So you got to answer this question I'm coming up with here. Let me make sure my queue is cleared. And the question is, I'm going to make this a two-part question. What kind of bite guard did Rick suggest, and where is his what he considered the best place to go look for muskies when he's out looking for structures? So that it is. So a two-part question: what kind of bite guard is he using, and where does he go to find the muskie that he likes to go to most often? And we have, I think, a winner here. I'll run this by you here. Rick, we've got an answer that says knotted, seven-strand knotted wire. Is that part correct?
Yeah, that would be good.
Mm-hmm. That would be good.
Yeah, knottable wire. Yep. Yeah, knottable wire.
And and also weed beds.
Yeah, I'd say that's very true. It's my go my go-to type structure. Yep.
Yeah, I think what I was looking more specifically for, and Jake Jones in Yukon, Oklahoma, got this, was that tiger wire you had mentioned. So, you're on the right track. So, if Rick approves, we'll get you that book out. Is that okay, Rick?
Yeah, I think that's good.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great, and. So, congratulations, Jake. Please send me your address in that same text box if you can, so that we can get that book sent out directly from Stackpole to you. So, appreciate you guys all playing and listening carefully, and hope you enjoy your prizes. Well, Rick, appreciate you being on us on the show again with us. You know, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and this was quite different, talking about muskie rather than steelhead. There was one other question. Let me just throw this out here because, Scott Nelson in Portland, Oregon asks, what type of fly fishing has higher catch rate, steelhead or muskies? you're the man to ask.
Well, I'd say, I wonder from a straight-up, catch rate standpoint. I mean, as difficult as steelhead is to catch, I would say that the steelhead has a little higher catch rate than muskies. I mean, that's just how difficult it is.
Yeah. Okay.
So steelhead are even easier to catch than muskies. I think the muskies are the toughest fish to, you know, the bar's raised pretty high from a fly fishing standpoint.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, good, good. I thought I had to know that answer as well anyway. So, okay, well, thanks for being with us again and taking your time out, and enjoy your fishing season, and thanks again for being with us.
You know, thank you, Roger. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Great. Our next broadcast will be on June 21st, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. In that show, I'll be interviewing Rod Hamilton, and our topic for the show will be do-it-yourself fly fishing vacations. Rod has been helping fly fishers find the best do-it-yourself vacations for many years. He's traveled the world looking for locations that have local fishing experts that can be called upon for help, accurate fishing reports, vacation rental properties, and other points of interest that you may want to explore while on your vacation. Many times it's not easy to find these locations, but Rod has made it happen. Join us and help me pick Rod's brain on how to make a do-it-yourself fishing vacation a memorable one. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Tarpon Key Lodge, Watermaster, Royal Gorge Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.